Doing something a little different tonight. The program has been reversed, and they're going to have the message first, and then the preliminaries last. I would like to just say that it certainly is a joy to be here at this staff conference. This is the third staff conference that I've ever been at. That is the third staff conference here in the United States. Most of my time has been overseas, evidently, and it is a real treat for us to be here. And we count it a privilege. And I know that everyone in Europe is a little jealous. Joyce and Leela and myself, and those of us from Europe who are here this week. And I know they're going to have many questions about this week when we have our staff conference in the fall. In case you're interested, the dates are October 23 to 29, and we certainly would appreciate your prayers for our little staff conference over there. We hope to be bringing much of the things that the Lord has been teaching here this week, over there. Tonight, I would like to speak on the subject, the servant of God. And I would like us to consider two aspects. One is one of the basic problems we face as being a servant of God. And two, some of the characteristics involved in being a servant of God. So first I would like us to think of one of the basic problems in being a servant of God. And if you'll turn to your Bibles to Matthew 20, we see one of the basic, if not the basic, problem Jesus faced with his disciples as he was seeking to train and equip and prepare them to being servants of God. In verse 17, Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him. And the third day he shall rise again. Now there isn't anything that could be more concise and clear, a better description of exactly what was going to happen to Jesus. Now notice verse 20. Then, immediately afterwards, came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, Well, what wilt thou? And she said unto him, Grant that these two sons may sit, the one at thy right hand and the other on the left, in thy kingdom. Jesus was trying to tell them something about himself. He was trying to share with them the deep concerns of his own heart. The cross was before him. But they were so interested about themselves and thinking so much about themselves that evidently Jesus hadn't even communicated to them. Hadn't even communicated the very heart and core of his purpose for coming. The very crisis of his life and ministry just around the corner. And they were so concerned about themselves and their success and recognition and reputation and so on that they hadn't even registered. And notice in verse 20, the mother had come to worship him. Why was she worshiping him? What was the driving force of her worship? That her two sons might be the right hand man and the left hand man of Jesus. What was the center of her petition and prayer? The same. And notice what Jesus said. Jesus is so gracious. I've really appreciated Dave's messages on showing us the love and the graciousness, the lowliness and the meekness of Jesus Christ this week. And he said unto them, well, verse 22, but Jesus answered and said, ye know not what ye ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of? And to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And I think here he is referring to the baptism of his death, to the cup that he was to drink. And they say unto him, now notice the sons are right there. Their mother has offered the petition, but they answer, we are able. We are willing to go through anything. Any dedication and sacrifice to be your right-hand man and your left-hand man. To sit the right hand and the left at your kingdom. And then you go on to verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. Boy, were they mad. The nerve! Why were their reactions so strong and heated? Because they wanted to be on the top too. C.S. Lewis says, the more pride we have, the more other people's pride irritates us. When I get upset about somebody's pride, it's a good indication what my problem is. C.S. Lewis goes on to say, man is not proud because he's rich, strong, smart, successful. But man is proud because he is richer than someone else, or stronger than someone else, or more successful than someone else. Pride is essentially competitive. I know we were trying to help our children along, and during prayer time, they always would argue about who was going to pray first. And so we thought it would be real spiritual and scriptural, and so we taught them the verse that he that is first shall be last, and he that is last shall be first. So now the problem is they all are arguing about who's going to be last. Can't seem to win for losing. But Jesus deals with the problem. And you'll note here that Jesus didn't rebuke them, but he did instruct them. But Jesus called them unto him and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And minister here means servant. I've wondered sometimes if we would introduce a minister. I would like you to meet my servant. Or I'd like you to meet our servant. Instead of our minister. Or if someone's introducing us, well, this is a fellow that's trained me or built in my life. If he would be able to say, this is a fellow who's been my servant. Whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came to be ministered unto, came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. And I would like us to consider tonight, are we coming to be ministered unto? This little phrase has been a rebuke to me and a great blessing to me. I know in my experience with the navigators that many times I've been too concerned about what people think of my ministry. What does the leadership think? What do people say? What is written in reports? If I'm speaking in a conference, do people come up and say, oh, that was a blessing? And if they don't, am I a little sunken? Am I more concerned about the reactions of people to me and to my ministry than I am in being a servant to the people? And I can remember when I was here at the Glen, though I never shared it with anyone that I can remember, there were some inner conflicts and tensions because I would begin comparing myself with someone else. And if I felt God was blessing him more than me, instead of rejoicing, there was that sunken, frustrated feeling that kind of tore inside. Because basically, evidently, I wanted to be ministered unto. There was maybe a competitive spirit. And I must say that I have to guard against this now. And vanity is defined, and vanity is just an outworking of pride, the love of being admired, praised, exalted by others. Am I basically in this ministry to be ministered unto? H.J. Taylor said the other morning that 99% of our problems is traced to selfishness. First Corinthians 11:31, if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. If we will keep short accounts, an inventory. And if we are sunken because we feel we don't measure up to some image or to some person, 1 Corinthians 10:24 has always been a blessing. Let have to look it up here. Let no man seek his own, but everyone another's wealth. And I found that one of the things that causes this inner frustration to disappear very rapidly is to seek another's wealth and to pray for them. What I'm trying to say is, where is the weight of your burden? The weight of your burden can be tested best by reactions. What is your reaction after you speak or concerning your work in an area? Is the weight of the burden on being a servant to the people there? Or is the weight of the burden to be ministered unto? I believe there's a real difference between a trainee, one who is being trained, and a trainer, if I can use these terms. And the difference is this: the trainee has come to be ministered unto, and the trainer has come to minister. And so, if a person is so overly concerned that they're not getting the training, if the weight of the burden is on this, that maybe there is a problem here in what is their heart response to the Lord and to the ministry. I can think of people who have said, well, I wouldn't like to take this ministry assignment because I've had this experience and I don't see where it will help me in my training. Or I've even talked to people about, as we've talked about overseas, and I've said, well, why do you want to go overseas? Well, I think it will be a good experience for me. I don't think you're ready to go overseas. I think that if a person is going overseas, it must be to minister, to give of themselves as a servant, as a bond slave to others. I know that I face, and I'm sure that we all face, some of these inner conflicts. And we probably will continue. For there is no temptation taking you but such as is common to man. I'm sharing some of the inner tensions and frustrations I've gone through, and I'm sure that you have too, because of 1 Corinthians 10:13. But there are certain things here which I think have helped me. And you know what causes these frustrations to evaporate? Is faith. Faith. I can remember in Europe many times asking myself, am I the man for the job? Should I even be with the navigators? Am I really as faithful as I should be? Do I have the gifts? Am I really able to accomplish the task set before me? And I think there were three studies which were a tremendous help to me. The first study that the Lord led me in was on the character of God. To study the Old Testament truths of the character of God. Most of my study was in the Old Testament. To know that He is faithful, He is merciful, He pities me as a father does his son. He loves me with an everlasting love. He says, here my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with you. And many passages, which I will not take time to go into, but just to give you one, Psalm 145, 8 and 9. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger, and of great mercy. The Lord is good to all. You know, that includes every one of us. The Lord is good to all. And His tender mercies are over all His works. And if I did not hope in the mercy of God, I could not be a servant. I could not be a servant. But what peace and rest there is in faith, in believing and trusting and depending on a God like this. And I would just throw out to you the idea of making a study on the character of God. And then in Hebrews, made a study on the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And not only His work on the cross, but His present work. Interceding for me. And then I went through Ephesians and did a study on the book of Ephesians and tracing the wealth that I have in Christ and the resources that I have in Christ. What's available? And you know what my conclusion was? I have no right to be disappointed. I have no right to be disappointed. I can be disappointed in myself, but still, I have no right to be disappointed. I remember talking to a fellow who was saying he was disappointed, dejected, because of his spiritual growth, his lack of gifts. And I began to think about this and pray about this because I wanted to help this dear fellow. And the Lord gave me, I think, this simple illustration. Every time I'd go on a trip, I'd try to bring something back to my kiddies. Just a little gift. But let's suppose that I brought this little gift. I didn't bring it back because they were good. You know our children, you'll probably understand what I mean. I brought it back because they were my children. And I loved them. And I wanted to please them. But let's suppose that my children said, "Oh, Daddy, this little gift, I wanted a gift like this." Next time, would I bring them a gift like this? No, I wouldn't. In everything, give thanks. God is at work in you. And Hudson Taylor said, there's one circumstance in life, and that circumstance is God. One circumstance in life, and that circumstance is God. He knows the numbers of hair on your head. His thoughts to you are more than the sand that is on the seashore. He hasn't left anything out. He hasn't overlooked something. I have no right to be disappointed if I believe the God of the Bible. I think that part of my problem and part of our problem is that perhaps we're building an image of ourselves that God has never created. But if we will leave this in His hands, He will faithfully work it out. Do we test every experience by saying, "Lord, what do You have in this for me? What is Your purpose in this? You have a purpose for good. Help me to learn it. Help me to learn it the first time." Are you letting God train you? You know, some of us are out far away, and some of us don't get many visits, and some of us don't get the training and supervision that our hearts long for and the fellowship. And I used to think, boy, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could be one of the 12 and just spend 3 years with the Lord Jesus. But you know, I spent about 15 years with Him now. 60. And not only has He been with me, He's been in me. And He's training me. He's training me. In every circumstance, in every situation in life. And I know there have been times when I've said, oh, if I only had more time. Oh, I say this all the time, especially since I've come to Glen Eyrie. If I only have more time. Or more gifts, or more growth. And I've had people come to me and say, if you only had this or that, then I think God would really use you. Have you ever had anyone come to you and say that? I have. And I've had many more insinuate it. Maybe they're right. But when they do, or when I do to myself, I get alone with the Lord. And I pray over the gifts. And I pray over the various things that the Lord is speaking to me, whatever it may be. And I say, Lord, You give severally as You will. This is the confidence that I have in You, that if I ask anything according to Your will, I know You hear me. And if You hear me, I know that I have the petitions which I desired of Thee. And I take it by faith that God and I are up to date. And He will take me according to His plan, purpose, and timetable. I have no question about that, because if I do, I question God. And this has been a help to me to get over some of these frustrations which come, I think, basically from the desire to be ministered unto. Then I would like to go into the next part. Came to minister. I would like us to give considerable thought from a positive point of view. To minister. To be a servant. To be a bond slave. Now, when I talk about this, I don't mean to infer that we should have a ministry-centered life. But a drive for ministry can be Christ-centered. It's not a drive to fulfill some cause. But it's a drive to minister to Jesus Christ. To co-labor with Him. A book that has been a great help to me is Hudson Taylor's book on union and communion, as he expounds on the Song of Solomon. And in Song of Solomon 7:12, he says, let us get up early to the vineyards. This is the Lord, or the bride, speaking. This is you and me speaking to the Lord. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourish, and whether the tender grape appear, and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give thee my love. We come to know Him as we're laborers together with God. We come to know Him as we minister to the members of His body, which are bone of His bone and flesh of His flesh. This is a love, a labor of love to Jesus Christ. And I think we should be more concerned about this labor of love to Him and with Him than we should be at concerning its results. For He takes care of the results. That's His business, not ours. And I think we should be laborers and servants in little things and in big things. I think of the time in Formosa when I went out to the East Coast, the mountainous area, among the Aborigines. The Denler twins and I went out there for a couple weeks. And we were working with a man, Pastor Lowe, wonderful man of God, Taiwanese, Formosan pastor, who's a missionary to the ex-headhunters there. And he had been Doss's interpreter when Doss was out there in Formosa. So I wanted to get some little gems, you know, secondhand that Doss may have given to him and that I could have got. And so I was saying to him, I say, well, tell me, what was some of the things that impressed you about Mr. Trotman and about what he said? And he said, well, he said, Mr. Trotman is about the most unusual foreigner I've ever met. Oh, well, tell me why. And he turned to me and he said, he shined my shoes. What was the impact that was made on this man of God? That Dawson Trotman shined his shoes. He was a servant in little things. And if you've been out in the Orient, and you know you as the foreigner, as the guest, and the Chinese, whether he be a pastor or what, he takes care of you. He sees that your shoes are shined. He sees that you're taken care of and fed and bathed and clothed and your schedule is taken care of. He is your servant. And he hadn't seen anyone like this. And an impact was made. I was flying over here for the Overseas Policy Conference. And I was praying. It was an all-night flight. I was praying that the plane wouldn't be too full and that I would be able to sleep. The plane was full. Every seat was taken. And there was a man sitting next to me. And when I'm tired and so on, I don't feel like witnessing. And I didn't want to talk to him. And I didn't want to witness. And hours went by, and finally, I started to talk to him. And lo and behold, here he was, a missionary himself. He probably was feeling the same way I was. A Moravian missionary to Dutch Guiana. And is that how you pronounce it, George? Latin America. And he told me of the early missionaries who went to that section. It was a Dutch colony. And the missionaries had gone there that they might minister to the African slaves. And the Dutch colonialists' view at that time concerning the African was that he was subhuman. And they would not allow the missionaries to go there and present the gospel. And so you know what the missionaries did? They became slaves. Lifetime slaves. And that church grew. That church was pure because they became slaves. When I say this, I don't say that I could do what they did. But I think it is something that we can hold up before us. When I'm thinking of ministry, I'm not thinking of a mechanical ministry, but a spiritual one. You know, there are two types of servants. You see them very clearly in 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 25 to 35. We don't have time to go into this in a lot, but I'll give you the passage and a few ideas. You can see two types of servants here. Elisha and Gehazi. Elisha saw the woman coming afar off. And this woman's son had died, and she was going to the man of God. And he saw her far off, and he told Gehazi to run to her and ask the question, "Is it well?" So Gehazi ran, and he asked the question, "Is it well?" And she said, "It is well." So he ran back, and he said, "It's well." Ever meet servants like that? The woman came to him, and she fell down at his feet. And Elisha, I don't believe, had to have a lot of spiritual insight when he said, "Her soul within her is vexed." But what did Gehazi do? "Come on, we're busy. Come on, get out of here. It's all well. You said it was all well. Hurry, get out of here." So Elisha said, "You go. Don't salute anyone. You just go straight to that house where that little dead boy is. And you lay the staff, my staff, upon his face." Okay, Gehazi, good key man, he went right there. He didn't talk to anyone. He did exactly what he was told. He laid the staff there on his little boy's face, and he came back and he gave his report. And you know what his report was? Well, you could guess. He had laid the staff upon the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Wherefore, he went again to meet him and told him, saying, "The child is not awake." He mechanically went through the motions. He was a servant, but there was no spiritual life and vitality and result from his going through the motions. And then you see Elisha, as he went up. And in verse 33, he shut the door and prayed unto the Lord. He went up and lay upon the child. He didn't just lay the staff upon the child. He laid himself upon the child. And we just cannot lay the nav basics and mechanics upon someone and see any life come from it. We must lay ourselves upon them. His hands were on the boy's hands. His eyes were on the boy's eyes. His lips were on the boy's lips. He was a servant who spread himself out before God and on this child. And something happened. The child came to life. This is a servant. And I would like to say that being a servant is not basically to get some men for our work. That's a case we've come to be ministered unto. And I'm very thankful for what Lauren said the other day. Some of you may not have been there. But manpower for the navigators should be a byproduct of our ministry and not an end product. The end product is to be producers of reproducers in every walk of life, in every key area of the world, being fruitful and multiplying, not as navigators, but as servants of Jesus Christ. And I would say that there probably isn't anyone, apart from George, who has to think of the whole world. Of course, Lauren, who has to think of everything. But when I think of the work in Europe, if there's anything I'm crying for, it's for men. We need men. Bordy, Jake, wherever you go in the world, we need them. This little chart doesn't even meet one area of overseas work. We could take the whole thing in the next 5 years in Europe. Not because we have statistics, but because we have people who are asking for help. Because we have open area and opportunities. But George could say the same thing concerning other areas of the world, Latin America or the Orient. So we've got to be praying and looking, but these should become a byproduct, not an end product. And in Europe, we found that until we were willing to be servants for Jesus' sake, people were not responding to us. I remember we were having our second half-day conference in Holland. We got some discussion group leaders together, and we were trying to train them in leading discussion groups. And this one fellow came to me and he said, "Now, I want you to know that I'm very busy. And if you're going to be asking me to try to help the navigators in the navigator program, I just don't have time." I said, "We haven't come to be ministered under. We've come to minister. And if what we're doing is not helping you in your Christian life and helping you in your Christian service, where you live, where you work, where you worship, please don't come. But we have come that we might minister to you and help you be fruitful and multiply where you are." And that fellow began asking for personal help. And we've seen others who've said, "Boy, you folks have been helping us. Isn't there something we can do for you?" And I've seen it in our home. The girls who come into our home, for example, I've oftentimes said to Leela, I've said, "Honey, they've come to help. This is just making more work for you." But this is one case where she was right and I was wrong. How did she win their hearts? How did she win them to the NAV vision? By being a servant. And we've got a letter from one girl who's over there in Sweden. She's quite a ministry going on now. But she has world vision. She prays for the areas here in the States, I think, probably more than I do. It's a confession. I do pray. But I think she prays more. She wrote, and it convicted me because she was so concerned about the lack of water supply here at the Glen. She had been praying about it. You see, we produce what we are, don't we? If we're a servant, we produce servants. If we have world vision, we produce people who have world vision. Why was I recruited to the NAVs? Because one afternoon at a NAV seminar, a NAV leadership conference, I guess is what you'd call it now, I had heard Doss and Dick Hillis preaching all week on the Great Commission. And I'd been out in an area where Don Rosenberger just drilled into us Colossians 1:28 and 29, and he lived it. This was his vision. This consumed his thought and his life. And I'd seen it in the area. I'd seen it in Don's life. So one afternoon I got alone with God, and some stakes were driven in. And my life was committed to the Great Commission. To Jesus Christ, yes. But to what's on His heart and His mind, the Great Commission. To be fruitful and multiply to the uttermost part of the earth. To make disciples and see them multiply. And I believe in the Minneapolis area, this was one of the unique things that God used to raise up men who are now working with the Navigators around the world. Leroy Ives, Bob Seifert, the Dendler twins, Ruth, Pat Nelson, Raj and Dottie. I'm just naming them that come into my head. Waldron Scott. And I know I'm leaving out some. Jake Combs. Because world vision was a thing that was the heart throb and the heartbeat of the men there in the area. And if you're getting them interested in a little program around a university only, when they're out of that university, you've lost them. Because the program is gone. Or at a serviceman's base. Or wherever it is. And I would like to ask some questions tonight. Now, I haven't been here in the States long enough to know the answers. Do we transmit bifocal world vision to our contacts in the area? Do they have a vision of reaching men and women for Christ and seeing them multiply in their area, and not only there, but unto the uttermost part of the earth? Is this vision in focus or out of focus? Is this vision God has given you just a little link in a chain? Or is it something big and vital to the fulfillment of the Great Commission? Is this something bigger than you? Bigger than your area? Bigger than the Navigators? Is this something you and God have met together on, and He has burned it in your heart and the flame is still kindling? Have the promises of God in this respect become so real to you that you have a sense of destiny? What is the need of the hour? Well, Dawson said it's not methods, it's not money, it's not machinery, and it's not men. And I'm glad that Lauren mentioned we ought to read what the need of the hour is, because you know we're talking about machinery, and we're talking about men, and we're talking about money, and there's nothing wrong in this. I'm 1,000% behind it. But the need of the hour is what? I believe the need of the hour, Dawson said, is an army of soldiers dedicated to Jesus Christ, who believe not only that He is God, but that He can fulfill every promise He has ever made, and that there is nothing too hard for Him. We don't need the 32,000 or the 10,000 in Gideon's army, but we do need the 300. And it's been a comfort to me, as I see we're so short on manpower, To just review, Judges 7, verse 2, and the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath delivered me. God may not give us the manpower we have on our chart. He may give us more, but He may not. But this doesn't mean that God cannot accomplish His purpose. When Jesus fed the 5,000, He was the one who got the glory. When the 300 defeated the Midianites, He was the one who got the glory. You know, the people didn't say, what wonderful, prolific fish. See how they multiply. Oh, what wonderful bread. Look at that multiply. Boy, is that terrific. Oh, what an outstanding young boy who came and gave a couple loaves of fish and a couple fish and some loaves of bread. Oh, look at those terrific disciples, how they distribute all this. Now, they had only one to glorify, they had only one to praise, and it was Jesus Christ. And the need of the hour, Dawson said, is a band of men who will believe this and who will trust Him to do it. Henrietta Mears, we often refer to her as the female Dawson Trotman, a woman who's been used to raise up men of God, a woman of faith. Remember out in the Orient when Dick Hillis told me they were having a conference up at Forest Home and nothing was breaking through. And she came up there one afternoon while they were having a prayer meeting. And when she prayed, heaven opened. And there were, after that prayer meeting, and after her prayer, there was a real break, and young men were making vital decisions for Christ. Dick wanted to get some time with her, and so he asked her if he could talk to her for a few minutes, and he said, Miss Mears, if you had one lesson that God has taught you above all else, what would you say it is? And she said this, I believe it is Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. And to my knowledge, when God has asked me to do something, I have by faith attempted to do it, no matter how ridiculous it seemed. Or how difficult it seemed, or how big it seemed. And then I read in Your Decision magazine, in a sense, her last paragraph a week or so before she died. And she said this, if I had my life to live over, I would just believe God. I would believe Him more and more. With never any feeling of doubt that anything is too ambitious in the Lord. Or perhaps He doesn't mean us to try this or that because it is too ambitious. Have unlimited vision under God. Have enthusiasm and faith in what God can do, beginning with things as they are, and having vision of what God has promised, so you will make an unbeatable team, you and God. A servant is one who has a labor of love and a work of faith. And in closing, I would like us to turn to Hebrews chapter 6. verses 12 through 15, and that ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing will I bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. And I would like to close with our thinking of this one thought, obtaining the promise. And God had no greater to swear by, so he swore by himself. And the promise of Abraham, as I've studied the New Testament and Old, is to you and to me. The promise of being fruitful and multiplying. Claiming the promise. And the first thing that's demanded is be not slothful. Be diligent. Faith without works is dead, being alone. A man who believes God has promised will wholeheartedly and enthusiastically dive into the project. Moody said, unbelief sees something in God's hand and says, I wish I had that. Faith sees it and says, I will have it, and gets it. And I can't help but think of Rog Anderson when I think of diligence. Rog has to work harder for most things than many of us do. And he does work harder. And he gets it. And whenever we had a half-day conference, or he was in an evangelistic meeting or something, he was praying, even while he was learning the language, Lord, give me a man. And he believed God, and he went out and worked at it. And I can tell you of man after man after man, which Roger got, because he believed God and was diligent about the Father's business. And we don't obtain the promises without hard work. I've never seen it. It is not because a person has ability. I'm sure of this. It's because a person is willing by the grace of God to work. And faith. You know, Abraham, the father of faith. You know what Abram means before he changed his name, before he received the promise? It means high father, like a high barren peak, like Pike's Peak. A barren peak. And old Abraham, by faith, changed his name. And you know what it means then? Father of a multitude. And here was old Abraham, 75 years old, up to 100 years old. He was going around calling himself, I'm a father of a multitude. And he didn't have a child. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God, being fully persuaded that what he had promised he was able also to perform. And then lastly, patience. This is the hardest one of us, for us, I think, for me. Patience. Who through faith and patience inherit the promises. And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. Blessing will I bless thee, and multiplying, I will multiply. And I believe that many fall off the race, out of the race. I've seen it many, many times. I've seen staff members come and go, my 12 years with the Navigators. I've seen key contacts come and go. And I believe it's basically because they have not been willing to patiently endure. And Abraham had to wait 25 years before he got Isaac. And I'm sure there were many who thought, Abraham just doesn't have what it takes to be a father. And when Abraham and Sarah got in trouble, what was the trouble they got into? Why did they get into trouble? Because of impatience. Sarah had come up with an idea how they were going to get their son. Through Hagar. And I can just imagine how Sarah felt that this supreme sacrifice which she was going to give, her husband, who she had very carefully guarded for herself all those, 90-some years? 70-some years. I don't imagine they were married at birth. But she had guarded him. He was wealthy enough to have a number of wives, but you notice he didn't have any. And you notice he didn't have to have his arm twisted to take Hagar. And yet, I can imagine Sarah feeling that she was giving the supreme sacrifice, her husband, to another woman. And you know, gang, I think that sometimes we fall into this. And I speak before you as one who's convicted because I believe that I have to be very careful lest I do not give the right priority to my family, to my children. I cannot sacrifice them to obtain the promise. This is impatience. I cannot sacrifice my time with the Lord in prayer and in His Word to try to obtain a promise. I have to be careful that I don't go off on some tangent, some effort that is more of self than of God to obtain a promise. And how did they obtain? Well, I'm not saying God was behind in His timetable. Maybe His timetable was 25 years. I don't know. But in Genesis 18, and I just give you the verses to look over, 1 through 14. The Lord appeared unto Abraham, and Abraham now was not preoccupied with obtaining the promise like he had been in the chapters before. Now he was preoccupied with the Lord Himself and how he might minister unto the Lord, to wash the Lord's feet. He wanted to go and prepare a meal, to make ready quickly. He got his servants to haste and fetch the best calf, and he took the Lord and put him in the shade of the tree, and he ministered unto the Lord, and then he stood there and watched to see if there was anything else he could do as a servant of the Lord. And then the Lord said this in the 14th verse, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed I will return unto thee, according to the time of life, in the springtime, and Sarah shall have a son, in whom all the families of the earth will be blessed." Of the Lord Jesus Christ. There is no greater privilege of service than this. Shall we pray?